This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Purcell. With the Memorial Day weekend upon us, it's the unofficial start of summer. The grass is growing, the trees have most of their leaves out, and the birds and other wildlife in your backyard are getting busy. This afternoon, you'll have a chance to get some answers about the flora and fauna in your backyard from two savvy naturalists from the Cincinnati Nature Center. You can call 513-419-7100. That's 419-7100. You can email us, talk at WVXU.org, post on the WVXU Facebook page, or by sending us a tweet. In the studio with me are Bill Creasy, the Chief Naturalist and Adult Program Coordinator at the Cincinnati Nature Center, and Lester Payton, a Naturalist and Visitors Center Services Coordinator at the center. Welcome back to Cincinnati Edition, guys.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Thank you.
Well, last time you were here, it was winter. We were discussing bird feeders and birds during the cold weather. Now it's summer. What is the difference between the birds we're seeing today and the ones we were seeing at the feeders in the summer?
They're a lot more colorful, basically. The winter ones are the ones that come down from Canada and Michigan to survive the elements and find good food source. And a lot of our birds that are here for the summertime have gone to the tropics. And when they come back, they've got their full plumage. So we're seeing blues and yellows and reds and oranges, just vibrant colors.
And so a lot of the birds that we see in the winter don't stay here for the summer, correct?
That's correct. There's some that are residents, but some of them are neotropical migrants, as I said, and they've been down in the southern U.S., Central America, and even northern South America, and they're now back.
So what about going the other direction? I mean, is that all south, and then, you know, come this time of year, they're moving back north? Or are there some that come south in the winter because it's warmer and stay more southerly?
So the birds that come down in the winter, you know, like Bill said, they're here trying to find food. It is warmer, and you know, once the temperature starts to get warm again, those birds are going to head back north.
As these birds are migrating, what kind of birds are we seeing who are moving through? Because there are some that are moving through and to points north, but they do spend a little bit of time here kind of recharging along the way, right?
That's right. They're refueling, and a lot of those are, well, there's a couple of grosbeaks, but mostly the warblers and the vireos. The sparrows and such were here for the winter. They're gone back north. But these migrants come through twice a year. So they're coming through right now with all these spectacular plumages, most vibrant colors possible. And then they'll swing back through in the fall when they head back south again. And the colors are a little bit more muted that time of year.
I was gonna mention, I don't know if it was mentioning or bragging, that you mentioned the grosbeak, that I saw an unusual bird in my feeder a couple of weeks ago, you know, black with a white chest or whatever, and a very distinct red triangle. So a rose, looked on my Peterson's guide, and a rose-breasted grosbeak. But they only stuck around for 2 or 3 days.
Yeah, most of those go further north. I know someone who had one nesting on her farm in Wilmington.
Really?
So you do get a couple of them that will nest here in Ohio, but certainly stronger nesting population in Michigan, throughout Canada.
So what birds are the resident birds? What birds are the ones that are sticking around here most of the time?
Yeah, we do see some that are here all 12 months. So, you know, the cardinals, the chickadees, Carolina wrens, birds of prey, the hawks and the owls, quite a variety that are here all the year through.
We're talking about birds and looking at the wildlife in your backyard on Cincinnati Edition on this Friday. You can call us at 513-419-7100 if you have a question. And I have a question right off. I've been dealing with some wrens that are nesting in my garage. I left the door open, started nesting there. What do you do when you find a bird nest in a place you don't want a bird nest to be? How do you know whether to leave it there until the baby birds fly off or take it out before things get too far along?
It depends how critical it is that you don't want the nest there. If the eggs are there, you should really leave it, and it's protected by federal and state laws that you do leave it there. But if they haven't put eggs in it and there's the first day they've started putting it together, then you can discourage them and try and dissuade them from using that site, and they will find someplace else.
So you don't have to feel like too much of a bad guy if you are moving the nest before there are eggs in it.
Right, right.
And, I mentioned the house wren. I also have phoebes, and I have one phoebe who is nesting on the top of my porch light by my front door.
And it's not so much that I mind it there, but I'm a little concerned that if I leave the porch light on, it might get too warm for the Phoebe. Is that true? Yes or no?
I don't think so. I mean, especially if you use a compact fluorescent light bulb, it's not going to generate heat. Yeah. So I think it would be okay. And the light will actually draw in insects, you know, which may be beneficial for the bird.
I wanted to ask about bird feeders, because it seems I was talking to one of my friends, my colleagues here at work, who is saying, you know, I have stopped putting bird seed in my bird feeders just because I figure the birds, they need to go eat the bugs out of my garden. Is it true that you should stop feeding birds at this time of year, or, you know, do you strike a middle ground?
I feed all summer long. I mean, I feed all year long. I do notice that in the wintertime, the birds will disperse, and there's not as many birds coming to my feeder in the early, you know, summer. But as birds breed, you know, they mate, they raise their young, they'll start bringing the young ones to the feeder. So then you start, you know, seeing more birds. And then it's cool to see, you know, like a red-bellied woodpecker fledgling come to the feeder, because it looks totally different than the adult bird. So, you know, the plumages are different. So that's a cool experience.
I take my feeders down. So this is a time when, like, I figure they can find their own natural foods. And I have my feeders right along the deck. And so just for hygiene purposes, you know, I don't want all that mess. In the wintertime, I can put up with it and then get out in the spring and hose it down. But I take the opportunity to take the feeders down, wash them in a 10% bleach solution, you know, one part bleach and 10 parts water, and then just put them away for a while. And I do make sure I try and get them up early, like in September, when the birds are starting to find their winter territories, where there's going to be a good food source for them.
Now, you mentioned cleaning the feeders, and that is important. I mean, I know people who just hang them up until basically they fall down, you know, keep filling it up. So, I mean, is it important to clean the feeders, and do you have to take any precautions when you're doing that?
Well, the fact that you're bringing a whole lot of birds into one area, it's higher disease transmission, because in the wild, they're not going to see one another interact that closely. But there is an eye disease in the house finches, maybe a conjunctivitis.
Yes.
Thank you. There's
Thank
the
you.
Word.
Excellent. You just didn't want to say it.
Yeah. and so, you know, disease transmission is a possibility. So you do want to, you know, try and keep it as clean and hygienic as possible.
Answer your bird questions here on 91.7 WVXU in Cincinnati Edition, 419-7100. That's 419-7100, the number to call. Or email us, talk at wvxu.org. Herb called in and says, vultures at Sailor Park overwintered, and that seemed unusual. Are more birds wintering here than before, is the question Herb asks.
Yeah, we've been seeing more vultures. We do a Christmas bird count every year, and for years and years and years, there wouldn't even be a turkey vulture in the area through the winter. And if you'd get one on the count, it was an exciting thing. This is the last 2 weeks of December, basically. And now we see them on a regular basis. Plus, there's a southern vulture called the black vulture that's come into the area. And now that that's arrived, both vultures are here throughout the winter season. And it's generally just one more supporting factor for this global climate change.
Mm-hmm. So being the weather being a little bit different, they're more willing to. It doesn't seem so the way the winter we just had.
Right.
It doesn't, not at all. 513-419-7100. Elizabeth from Middletown, you're on Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you. Yes. I am retired right now. I live in Middletown. And I've observed birds my whole entire life. We had a dove nest right outside my window when I was just, you know, 4 years old. And I've observed birds my whole life. I've enjoyed feeding them all year round. My question is, and you were just talking about something related to climate change and some birds that may not migrate every year. And so my question is, am I seeing things, or can it be true that the last two winters anyway, I have noticed some red-breasted robins in the wintertime. You know, like outside my window, I first noticed them, you know, outside my father's house two winters ago in Kentucky, and they looked like really big fat birds, and I looked at them with my binoculars, and I said, well, huh, that's a red-breasted robin. Well, maybe they're not fat. Maybe they fluffed up their feathers to keep warm, but don't they usually eat worms? And what might they be eating?
Well, Lester, you're kind of shaking your head. Sure. I'm going to throw this to Lester here.
Great question. You know, robins at one time were the harbinger of spring. So, you know, you would expect the robins to go, you know, farther south in the wintertime, and then we wouldn't see them again until spring. Things have changed with that, you know, with the warming of the climate. We see robins more in the wintertime, and they'll flock up, and they'll move around together, and they look for berries. And what they'll do is when they find a source of berries, they'll pretty much deplete that source, and then they'll move on. And these flocks will kind of roam around, you know, all over the country through the wintertime. And then they'll make their way back, you know, north once spring comes. So now, in my mind, the true harbinger of spring is the red-winged blackbird. And you'll start hearing those birds. And you can find red wings sometimes in the winter, but you start hearing them sing usually around the beginning of February or so.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting you mentioned berries, because I happen to talk with, I've got an uncle up in the Boston, Massachusetts area, and I asked him about it too, and he said, yeah, well, he's seen some too, but he's also seen berries, you know, mm-hmm. even up in New England, they have the huckleberries
sure.
and stuff, you know, and so, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned berries, so.
And about your observation yeah. about the birds looking fat, birds will fluff up in the wintertime. It's kind of like if us wearing a down coat.
Yeah.
You know, they fluff up and it traps that heat between their feathers and the skin so to keep them warm.
Thanks for your call, Elizabeth.
Actually, she didn't do the fluff up activity. So, well, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
And you talked about, I happen to have my iPad here in the studio with us, and I was going to share a little bird song. And we'll talk about bird song and how to identify birds, since all the leaves on the trees tend to make bird watching a challenge sometimes. But you talked about the red-winged blackbird, and this is the song that Lester was talking about, the red-winged blackbirds making as the harbingers of spring. If I can get it to go. Well, so much for that technology. It'll start screaming here in a minute, I bet. 513-419-7100. Bob from Anderson, you're on Cincinnati Edition.
Great. Thanks for taking my call. And all this talk about, you know, attracting birds and, you know, getting birds to your, you know, in your yard. We have kind of the opposite problem. We have a cedar siding house. We've lived there for about 10 years. And we have a lot of birds that like to poke or peck holes into the siding and then try to nest in there. And if I can keep up with them, I can patch the holes quickly when they just start. But if I don't keep up, they occasionally have gotten in and actually laid eggs in the siding. I have waited up to, you can hear the bird, the babies crying, begging for food. And then about June, they usually move on and I'll patch the hole. But I've never been able to stop them. I actually hung fake owls up, thinking maybe the owls would scare them away. Well, they figured out what the owls were, and basically they would just sit on them and, you know, do you know what on them. They really didn't care about that. Any ideas? I mean, I love having the birds in the yard, but really don't want them living in my walls. Any idea how to stop that from happening?
Okay, I'm throwing it your way, Bill.
Well, you might have a conspiracy going on here. I think you've got two birds working together. Woodpeckers are known for pecking holes in the siding. And we're not sure, you know, a lot of times it's treated stuff, but they're pecking on it anyway. Birds' bills continually grow throughout their lifetime. So one of the activities of using their bill helps to wear it down. But maybe it is some old siding. We've got a red-winged blackbird singing in the background. I hear it finally.
Finally.
The technology caught up with us. But I think it's probably woodpeckers. And then they usually don't nest in that area, but I'm guessing a starling, which is very opportunistic, is come along and see in that hole, and they are known to, you know, anytime there's some flashing that's pulled away or a gutter that's broken, starlings are happy to live around human habitation. So I'm expecting that it's probably two birds. And what you can do that works really well, birds are afraid of being caught. So you go to your local hardware store or nursery supply store, and you buy some netting that they use to put over cherry trees. And you just put a couple of eye hooks up along, it's usually higher on the house, so maybe along the roof line, and hang this netting. They're usually in good lengths of 20 or 30 feet even. Hang that down over the area, and the birds will just abandon that. Now, if you're going to have a social gathering or, you know, your daughter's getting married and you want the house to look perfect, you know, take the netting down. But otherwise, at least through the nesting season or when these birds are actively doing this, hang that netting up, and they usually just stay away from that. The static owl or even a rubber snake, it's called habituation. Birds at first might be put off by it, but eventually they say, that's not real. You know, they have a little bit of sense, and so the birds just think it's just an inanimate object once it doesn't move.
All right, Bob.
That's a great idea. Hey, one more quick question. There are a couple spots where they're nesting right now. Should I wait to hang the netting until they have moved on? I mean, I don't want to scare the parents away and leave the babies behind, right?
If you're sure they're starlings, I would remove them. And starlings are what we can call an invasive species, and they are not protected by law, so they can be removed. If you're okay doing that. But I would make sure they are starlings first.
They're non-native. And if you just want to double check, you know, take a picture of it and send it to us at the Nature Center. We'll identify it for you.
Sure.
Great. Well, I appreciate your help. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. We're talking about birds, and here's that red-winged blackbird that you will hear in the spring. So that is the harbinger of spring these days, according to Lester Payton here, who is joining me from the Cincinnati Nature Center, and Bill Creasy, taking your calls at 419-7100. Tom from Indiana, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hello there, Tom.
Hello there.
Well, I'm glad that I caught the show. I have kind of a unique situation. I live in the country. Well, at any rate, I got a set of nesting eagles that have moved into the area, and they are preying on the bird feeders and the hawks and everything else in the area. I certainly don't want to hurt the eagles, but what do I do to protect the birds?
that's a bit of a conundrum, isn't it?
Are you sure it's the eagles that are, because eagles normally wouldn't prey on birds at a bird feeder.
Well, I saw them take hawks out of the air. I've seen them take birds out of the air.
That I can see, and I've seen that as well. And usually if another bird gets too close, a red tail or you know, even a great horned owl, the eagle will dispatch whoever comes into their territory, and they can do it very well.
Oh, they're very efficient, yes.
But, you know, they're just, if they are nesting, they are going to protect their nest.
So, well, I understand that, and the last thing I'd want to do is to harm them.
Yeah, I mean, it's nature's way. You know, okay. the birds will work it out, they'll figure it out. But, you know, eagles are federally protected species, so harming that bird would not be in your best interest. Right.
It's not even in my consideration.
Okay.
They're beautiful. I was just wondering if there was something to do, because I do notice that they hover around where the bird feeders are and catch birds leaving or coming towards the feeder. So I just shut the feeder off?
I guess you could. You know, you could try to, you know, remove the food from the feeder. And that way, you know, the birds won't come to it, and then, you know, the other birds won't prey on them. Yes, you could do that.
I'm curious. Do you have a lake or a river nearby where this nest is?
Lots of lakes.
Okay, because the dominant food they're going to go after is fish. So outside of
fish and ducks.
I saw him take about a 12-pound catfish out of the lake the other day.
Wow.
That sounds like you've got bald eagles. That's the exciting thing.
Yeah,
I mean,
it's
great to have that bird, our national symbol, in your area.
And as much as it's horrible to watch him pick off the other birds, there's not really a lot that can be done shy of as what Lester said there, Tom, to, you know, don't put feed in the bird feeders as to not give them some fast food takeout. As it goes along. So, well, thanks.
Okay. Well, that's my question, and I appreciate the answer.
Well, thank you very much for your call. And lucky guy there getting to see some nesting eagles.
Definitely.
513-419-7100. Talking the birds here with a couple of folks from the Cincinnati Nature Center. You can join us at 513-419-7100. Lillian in Camp Denison, you're on the air.
Yes. I'm not talking about a bird, but I am talking about a harbinger of spring. Every year I note the date when I first hear spring peepers. Well, guess what? I didn't hear a single one this spring. What's happened to them?
Good question.
We've got them in good numbers at the Nature Center. Yeah. In fact, their chorus kind of came along. We had some weather that fluctuated up and down, so they came and they sang, and then it got cold for a while. They were silent, but then they came back and they sang again. So I don't know. I'd say it's something local that's happening in your immediate area. Maybe the habitat's changed somehow.
So what is a peeper, for those who don't know what a peeper is?
Yeah, spring peeper is a small member of the tree frog group, actually. They've got little tiny suction cups on their fingers, so they can go up and down vegetation. They usually stay fairly low in grasses and shrubbery. They don't climb trees like a gray tree frog. But in the spring, they gather in large numbers and have a single-note call that's just... And then when you get hundreds of them, it's just chaos. I mean, we had some groups out at the Nature Center for our frog events, and it's deafening. You just want to get away from the pond when they're all singing so loudly.
Classified as torture.
Yes. Well, thank you, Lillian. And I have to say, now that you mention it, I don't know whether I've heard the peepers I usually hear around my house this year. I might have to look into that.
It's usually March. So, I mean, fairly early in the season.
I missed them this year. 513-419-7100 or talk at WVXU.org. Kurt from Mount Airy, you're on the air.
Hi there. I have another question about robins.
Okie doke.
There's about four or five of them that feed in my backyard all the time, and I can distinguish them mostly by their markings. One in particular doesn't feed from the grass like the others, you know, picking up worms and other bugs. He goes out in the woods and the other runs over leaves and scratches under logs. I'm wondering if this is a normal behavior for robins or some kind of evolutionary change.
Who wants to handle this one?
I mean, it's quite normal to me. I've seen robins, forest robins. You'll see lawn robins, suburban robins, and then you'll see robins that you'll find in the woods. And the behavior I've seen of forest robins are they turn over the leaves, and you know they're finding earthworms, salamanders, anything that they can scarf down. And then the robins in the lawn, the suburban robins, just walk around the lawn and pick up insects that way.
I think it's a little bit too early to say that, you know, this could be a differentiation that will result in two different species or subspecies. But, you think about the human activity and all the different little niches that we have filled, and I think there's just robins taking the opportunity to find a variety of food sources and to utilize that resource.
That's Bill Creasy, the Chief Naturalist and Adult Program Services Coordinator at the Cincinnati Nature Center, and also here in the studio, Lester Payton, a naturalist from the center. We'll talk more about flora and fauna in your backyard when Cincinnati Edition returns in just a moment on 91.7 WVXU. Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I have in the studio with me some naturalists from the Cincinnati Nature Center, Bill Creasy and Lester Payton. We're talking about birds and frogs and a little bit of everything today. If you have a question, you can call us at 419-7100. That's 419-7100. Or email us talk at wvxu.org, post on Facebook, or send us a tweet. We're answering your questions, and I had a quick question before we go back to the phones here, and I'll throw it both your directions here. What is the normal span if I have these wrens that are in my garage, I see the eggs in there, I leave the nest in there, what is usually the length of time that nest needs to stay there before the baby birds leave the nest? I mean, is there a good average rule of thumb?
I would say you're probably looking at, once they start building, nest completion could take 5, 7 days or so, and then they'll start laying the clutch of eggs. And the female will usually lay an egg a day. There could be 4 to 5. That's probably about the, 5 is probably about the average size. And then you're probably looking at maybe another 3 weeks or so for, you know, for the little guys to hatch, and then probably about another 2 weeks for them to fledge.
Okay. Well, I've told you before we went on the air about the wren nest in my garage and how I walked out one day and let's just say they were fledging all over my garage. I walked in and it was a cacophony of chicks flying through the air. It was pretty fun.
Great word.
513-419-7100. Phil in Batavia, welcome to Cincinnati Edition.
Thank you.
So, do you have a question for Bill or Lester here?
Just a real quick question. I have a couple of berry bushes that I put in a couple of years ago in my backyard, and I have failed to be able to get a berry off of it prior to the birds taking them off. And I was wondering if they could tell me a few deterrent techniques. I can tell you what I've tried so far is, of course, I have the pie pans out there for the flash and the noise. They're completely over that now. So I was wondering if they had any other ideas.
Okay. Well, you mentioned netting before.
Yeah. I'd go back to that cherry netting. Again, the hardware store or local nursery store, just call ahead and make sure they stock it. But, if you want the berries for yourself, you've got to do something to discourage the birds. And most visual things, they'll get used to. So something that'll be physical and they can't get to the berries themselves.
Or you could stand in front of the bush, Phil, and just wave your arms all the time, too.
that might work. One thing that worries me about the netting is there any chance that birds could get caught in it and not be able to get away? Is there any harm that netting could do to the bird? Because, honestly, I'll give up my berries for birds.
Yeah, there's always that chance. Whenever you, put something like that out there, there's always a chance that a bird could get wrapped up in that.
I got a call a number of years ago from one of the Nature Center members who had netting over a bush. It was a low juniper of some sort. And she said, I've got a 6-foot black rat snake in the netting. I said, I'll stop by after work. So all we do is, The snake was somewhat tired. Apparently, it struggled for a while before she found it. And then I just gently, took a scissors and cut each of those loops, and it just went away just fine. No foul.
Okay.
All right.
I just wanted to check with that, too. Thank you so much for that.
Thank you, Phil. Thanks. And that was a question I had for you, because I have a couple of blueberry bushes I was planning on putting in my backyard, and that's one thing I heard. Yeah, got to watch out because those birds like those berries.
Yeah.
So 513-419-7100. Bob in Hidden Valley, you're on the air.
Thank you. I have a question. I'm going to add another critter to your menagerie.
Okay.
We love sitting on the deck and watching the birds and watching them come to our feeders. I should put that in the past tense because we can no longer do that. We had uninvited guests. I'd love to have those eagles, by the way, but our uninvited the uninvited guests came with masks. They were raccoons. And, first they went for the suet, and then we removed that. And so no longer saw pileated woodpeckers, which we had seen right up there on the deck. And then they went for the bird food. And from what I've heard, none of those so-called squirrel-proof feeders really deter raccoons. Any suggestions?
We've got the same situation at our nature center, and so we went to the baffles. And the 15-inch baffles, the raccoon can reach around, but they have some longer ones that are 30 inches. This is basically similar to a 6-inch PVC pipe, if you will, that's sealed at the top, and it's got a washer-like device that keeps it from sliding up or down the pole any further. And so these 30-inch ones, they can't get around, and we've eliminated all raccoon interaction. They're at the bottom of the feeders now. They're looking for anything that, a blue jay happened to knock off the feeder. But we finally solved that problem, and it's saving us a lot of money because raccoons, like you say, can really get in and go through the feeders.
Oh, explain the baffle again.
It's on a central pole, if you will, like a boat peep pole, and we've got some that have 3 or 4 different arcs coming off the top, and you can hang a different feeder. So one's thistle seed, one's sunflower, one's suet, and one's peanuts, and get a variety of birds that way. But this baffle device is on that central pole that holds all the feeders.
And wow. I've used a piece of ductwork that I found in my basement for mine, and it works, you know, just as, you know, like a baffle would, but it's a lot cheaper.
So what you're saying is make the pole big around, big enough around that the raccoon can't hug it
exactly.
and climb up it.
Exactly.
So I guess raccoons don't shinny, is that what you say? Yeah,
if it's made of metal and they can't get a hold of it.
Oh, okay.
So they slip.
Well, I'll come by the Nature Center and steal your ideas.
Yeah.
Come on out.
That sounds great,
I'll
Bob.
Take care of you.
Thank you very much, Bob. 513-419-7100. We had a email or something on the computer here. John from Mainville asking, are pileated woodpeckers common here, and do they stay all year?
Yeah, they're quite common in what we call big woods. They like larger trees, so larger tracts of forest. You'll find pileateds. You know, you usually hear them. I mean, they're the size of crows. These things are huge for a woodpecker. But you normally hear them.
Here, I'll
play
you.
Before you see them,
keep on talking, and let me find that particular call, because I have actually, to tell you the truth, John, I have two pairs of pileated woodpeckers that live in my yard close by, and a very distinct, very very distinct call that they make. Come on. Oh, technology! Don't you just love it?
In the 40 years I've been at the Nature Center, their numbers have increased.
And as you can see, they're very recognizable. Yes. And they look like Woody Woodpecker flying across the backyard, too.
I see them flying across 275 on my drive to work sometimes. And, you know, they never occurred on those numbers previously. But, yeah, there's a healthy population out there now.
But they tend to be shy. That's why I think a lot of people don't see them. I mean, I get, you know, you talk about the big woods. However, I was up at a corner store the other day that was in a residential neighborhood and saw a pileated about 2 feet off the ground at the house next door, you know, and probably not 20 feet from a pretty busy road.
Mm-hmm. So. And I'm sure there were some large trees around.
Yes, you know,
maybe a nice tract of forest, you know, that had some large trees in it. And they will visit, you know, residential areas, feeders in the wintertime. And you normally see them just a couple feet off the ground feeding.
And they leave humongous holes in those trees, too.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking 2-3 inches in diameter most of the time.
And with the emerald ash borer, which is a small little insect that came over from Asia that's killing our ash trees, we may see a spike in population of woodpecker species.
I thought the emerald ash borer didn't really have any natural enemies here, but the woodpeckers will go after the borers?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they can eat the larva.
Oh, excellent.
But, you know, if there's more dying ash trees, then... You know, there's more habitat and there's more food for the woodpeckers.
513-419-7100, talking flora and fauna in your backyard on Cincinnati Edition today. Pat from Clifton, you're on Cincinnati Edition. Welcome.
Hello. I was calling to find out why a bird would, like, attack a glass window over and over and over again. It was a robin.
Yeah. Well, the bird's seeing its reflection, and this time of year, you know, all the boys are jousting one another for the best territories, and you know, the female. So it's pretty much it's fighting itself in the window. So it's sent, the term bird brain is good to be used here. So
I think she asked, is there anything she can do about that?
What you'd want to do is try to break up the reflection. Try to do that from the inside, maybe. Pulling a curtain closed, or just placing something in that window that breaks up the reflection.
Okay.
You could try the old rubber snake trick on the outside, maybe on the windowsill. That may discourage the bird as well.
Okay.
All right. Well, thanks, Pat.
All right. Thank you very much.
Now, I have this issue, too. I just got new. I had to replace some windows last year, and one of them's a very large picture window. A lot of wide open reflection there. And I'm constantly hearing birds thump into them. And I was concerned about what that does to the bird. I mean, I've not yet found a clutter of bodies, you know, underneath the window or anything. Yeah. But I think I just recently saw a report that actually those collisions aren't always fatal to the bird. Is that right?
Right. And if you find a bird that's kind of dazed, what we recommend is that you pick it up and just put it in a brown paper bag and close the top. and give that bird some time to recover. And just the quiet, you know, in the wintertime, you're bringing it into your house so it's warm. And you just remove all the stimuli so the bird can try and, you know, get itself back together. And then when you go to check the bag, it's important to make sure you're outside, because oftentimes that bird will just come shooting right out of that bag, and you don't want it to hit the window from the inside right. when it just finished it hitting it from the outside. So
when would you want to put it in a bag? Most of the time, you know, sometimes I see the bird that after it's run into it, a lot of times I don't, but I had one that ran in and into the window and landed on my deck, and I just left him there, you know, made sure he was kind of protected, but, you know, eventually he just, I guess, became less dazed and confused and just flew away. When should you intervene, and should you intervene?
I think it's our windows that are causing the problem, so I think we should intervene. Now, if the bird is able to shake it off in a minute or two, and the minute you go to reach for it, it flies off, obviously it wasn't that hard of a window strike. But if it's really dazed, it's open predation. And we, you know, our hawk populations have become more and more healthy, too. With the elimination of DDT in the food chain, there's a hawk called a Cooper's hawk that used to nest further north of us. Well, now we see Cooper's hawks year-round here, and they're nesting in neighborhoods. And they are a bird specialist. That's the only thing they eat is other smaller birds, songbirds. So I think it's to the songbird's advantage if you can, you know, put it in that paper bag to recover rather than allow it to sit outside and be exposed, especially if it's sitting on a deck and it's kind of wide open. Easy prey.
Well, we heard about the eagles picking off birds at bird feeders, and I have seen a hawk do that. Does that mean that that's probably a Cooper's hawk versus a redtail?
Yes. Cooper's hawk or a sharp-shinned hawk. We don't have sharpies that often nested in the area, but we've got a lot of Cooper's hawks in the area now. And yeah,
it's specialists. Pretty fascinating to watch it about 6 feet off the ground picking them off.
And coops have learned too, if they flush birds, they'll actually run into windows and, you know, knock themselves out, and then it's an easy meal for the bird. I had one do that in the wintertime at the Nature Center. Cardinal ran into the window. I walked over to the window. I looked out, and there was a Cooper's hawk sitting in the tree. So then I went over to lock the door because I was locking up at night. I came back. The coop was gone, and the cardinal that was laying on the ground was gone as well.
Wow. So no bird brain there.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Smart bird.
That's Lester Payton, a naturalist at the Cincinnati Nature Center. Also here is Bill Creasy, the chief naturalist at the Cincinnati Nature Center, taking your calls at 513-419-7100.
I just want to add something, too, about windows. If you want to find out more about window strikes and how you can,
mitigate them.
Yeah, prevent them. American Bird Conservancy is a great website to go to. It's abcbirds.org, I believe, is the website.
We'll try to get that on our website, wvxu.org, and you will find a link to the Cincinnati Nature Center there. Back to the phone, Mary Jane in Winton Place. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Since I put up feeders 7 years ago, I have been noticing among the other house sparrows or weaver finches some that have a bluish tinge where the others have gray. And I've not seen this anywhere else. And there's 3 to 5 of them consistently over the years. So what could be, why is it that they have this sort of teal color?
Hmm.
I don't know.
Wow, I've never heard of a teal-colored,
I've seen house sparrows that are sooty, just even down here in Cincinnati. You'll see them. They look dirty, and, you know, they're hanging around the smokestacks and car exhaust, so they pick all that those particles up on their feathers. So maybe these birds are, I don't know, maybe there's
area,
a...
And somehow, but it's consistent.
Yeah.
For over 7 years, and it's definitely a bluish color, and you can see them perched, I mean, in the tree and stuff. I mean, it catches the eye, and it's very odd.
I'd say if you have a friend that's got a camera with a big lens, it'd be worthwhile to try and get a shot of that. And again, get it to us out at the Cincinnati Nature Center. We've got all sorts of contacts, and we'll try and figure out what's going on.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mary Jane. You might have something quite exotic there.
Yeah, Smurf sparrows.
Smurf sparrows. Cincinnati Edition on 91.7, taking your calls at 419-7100. Steve in Westwood, you have a question for Bill or Lester here?
Yeah, I drive State Route 128 every day. And I see cardinals come out to the roadway right on the line where the berm is. And when my vehicle approaches really close, all of a sudden they fly off. And it looks like they're playing chicken.
Well,
and you can almost always see a female around. And at first I thought, well, they're getting gravel from the edge of the road or something. But I never see them peck at the road. They just fly out there. They stand there. And then when you're getting close, all of a sudden, boop, they fly off. And that's the only thing I can say. I think they're playing chicken.
That's some unusual behavior there. Yeah. Like you said, they do get the grit. Birds don't have teeth, so they can't chew, and they you know, eat the grit, and then it's in their gizzard to help, you know, grind up the food that they do intake, get into smaller particles. So they constantly have to be replenishing that throughout the seasons. Even in the wintertime, you'll see birds getting the grit along the side of the road. But the idea of playing chicken, I don't know.
I drive State Route 128 every day, too, so I'll have to watch out for that behavior.
We'll have to see. Sorry, Steve. I don't know if we have a good, solid answer for you, but, you know, your speculation might be right in the right direction. So thanks for your call. We had another email. I believe it's an email I missed. Jim from Fort Thomas asks about butterfly bushes, that he's heard that butterfly bushes are actually bad for butterflies. Is that true?
Well, I've never heard that one. The one thing I have heard and actually seen for myself, that in some areas of the country, the butterfly bush is very invasive. It becomes what we have with the bush honeysuckle invading all the natural areas. Butterfly bush can become invasive. But around here, we get such hard winters, oftentimes people have to replant because it gets frozen down to the ground and even the rootstock can get affected. But I've not heard that it's bad for butterflies. In fact, we have it in the butterfly garden out at the Nature Center.
I've seen that. I had not heard that either. Thank you for your question there, Jim. Christopher from Trenton, you're on Cincinnati Edition. Hello.
Hi there. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Do you have a question for the guys here?
I do. I run a YouTube channel and website where I use a GoPro camera to just capture various nature things. It's kind of like a hobby of mine.
Sure.
And I was just wondering, what are the best techniques to catch the bird behavior without actually inhibiting the birds in any way?
I'd say you might follow the ideas of turkey hunters and duck hunters and find some sort of a blind setup where you could there's movable photo blinds that people can utilize or camouflage. And certainly going to areas where there are feeders or areas where the birds are nesting, and just use your common sense. You don't want to ever push a bird too hard for that, quote, National Geographic picture. You want to make sure that you're always respecting the animal and their space.
What about, as you said, with the owls and the snakes, if you have a camera and put it in a particular position near a feeder like that, will they get used to it and not be disturbed?
That's right. Yeah, that could be another situation. We have a couple of bird blinds out at the Nature Center, which are structures with a slot cut along the side where camera lenses and binoculars can be extended through, and there's feeders there. So people come and capture birds at the feeders.
You're getting your questions answered this afternoon from a couple of naturalists from the Cincinnati Nature Center. You can join the conversation or ask a question at 419-7100. Paul from Dent, you're on the air.
Hello, how are we today?
Very well,
good.
Thank you. Learning a lot.
Good. In the past, I've been successful to bring bluebirds into the yard and feed them and have them nest on the property. But I'd like to go to orioles. Can you give me some good ideas to bring them in and keep them around the yard?
Yeah, great question. Oriole feeders are all the rage right now. And a lot of my friends up north have fed orioles for years, and it's really starting to catch on. And grape jelly is a magnet for orioles. And, you could go to a wild bird store and actually purchase an oriole feeder, or I'm sure you could probably come up with, look online and maybe possibly make one yourself.
What distinguishes an oriole feeder?
Well, it's...
I haven't really looked at it.
Okay, it's orange. It's usually some type of orange material, and I'll cover the oranges here in a second. And then there's a small glass, you know, it's kind of like a cup holder. And you just fill that thing up with jelly, hang it up, and the Orioles love it.
Hmm.
There's some YouTube videos online of Oriole feeders. You can just Google it, and you can actually watch the Orioles feeding from the cup of grape jelly. You can also take oranges and half them, cut them in half, and just stick them on a tree like a spike, and that also attracts Orioles.
With the grape jelly, you do want to bring that in at night if you've got raccoons and other wildlife.
Does that give you enough to work with, Paul?
I think so, but what are the chances of keeping them around the yard, and do they migrate?
Yes, they are migratory. We do have Baltimores, you know, that nest in our area. You could do a what we call a nest ball, or it's string and all kinds of material that you can actually hang out, you know, hanging out on a tree limb, and that may, you know, if the Orioles are going to nest in your area, they may, you know, come down to that ball and actually pull some of that material out and add it to their nest.
Another key factor is you need big trees. They like big sycamore trees, maples, and so forth, but they need big trees. They want to nest up in those upper branches, a good 40, 50 feet off the ground.
Right, and if you have a water source, too, if you go down along rivers, I know a buddy who canoes, and, I mean, he does an Oriole count every year, and, I mean, he down the Whitewater River, and he counts, you know, 50 Orioles in this stretch, you know, by finding their nests hanging over the water.
Okay, awesome. Well, I'll give that a try. I'll put the grape feeder out by my pond in the front yard, and possibly the water source would help that too.
There you go.
All right.
Thanks very much.
Thanks for your call, Paul. Cincinnati Edition here on 91.7 WVXU, talking about birds and other things that are in your backyard with Bill Creasy, the chief naturalist at the Cincinnati Nature Center, and with Lester Payton, a naturalist from the center. Christine in Clifton, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I was listening to the woman who saw the house sparrows with the bluish tint.
Yes.
And I was wondering if that could possibly be like an immature indigo bunting.
Well, certainly it could be. Most of the indigo buntings, you know, the females are all brown. I'm guessing by the habitat, though, you know, indigo buntings need that kind of edge effect. I was assuming by her questions and calls that maybe this was something she had in her backyard. Certainly the indigo buntings do have that immature color, or even the ones, the males. One year we had one that spent the winter at the Nature Center. It didn't read the book. They were supposed to go to Central America, and it had that bluish color. But the other thing that occurs to me with the house sparrow question is, you know, there's variation within a species, and maybe some of these are just slightly a different hue or something. Imagine making a field guide to, you know, the planet Earth, and you put one illustration of a human being in that field guide. What color and shape would you make that human being? So, you know, the field guide is just kind of a directional finder, and certainly there's plenty of variation within any group.
Thank you very much for the suggestion there, Christine. We got time for one more call. We only have a couple of minutes left. Misty from Norwood, you're on the air. When you have a question for Bill and Lester.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My daughter, they were going to throw a bird nest away at work that they had taken out of a light fixture. There were five, the best we can figure, European starlings. She has raised them for the last 16 days, and yesterday three of them actually flew off into our tree. And we just wanted to know, is there anything that we could continue to do to help them to survive, or is it likely they will survive?
Well, Lester's shaking his head because I think because the starlings are invasive that he doesn't agree with your with what you've been doing, but we'll see here, Lester.
I applaud the effort and great job. They will survive. Starlings are they're in every state in the United States, and they're
very resilient,
highly adaptable. You know, they will survive. They're cavity nesters. They like to nest, you know, amongst us, houses, any crevice they can get into. You know, they'll do okay.
You would not have raised them?
I would not have, just because I know the impact of what they do. They displace other cavity nesters, redheaded woodpeckers. Have suffered because of the starling, but also because of habitat loss. So me being the science guy that I am, I would not have raised those birds.
But still a good job there.
Yes.
Still
a good job.
It's a good lesson for the children. Good lesson for children.
Exactly.
Okay, thank you.
Yep, you're welcome.
Thank you very much, Chris. Misty, thank you. And thank you, Bill. Thank you, Lester, for being here today. Very interesting questions and learned quite a bit from y'all.
Fun to be back.
Yep.
Thank you.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Bill Creasy, the chief naturalist at the Cincinnati Nature Center. Lester Payton, a naturalist and visitors services coordinator at the center. You'll find a link to the Cincinnati Nature Center on our website, wvxu.org. And we're sorry to the other folks whose calls we didn't have time to take today. We'll have Bill and Lester back later to answer those questions. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Technical director for today's show was Kevin Rowinski. Producer was Pete Reitmeier, with help from Kevin Reynolds. William White composed the Cincinnati Edition theme music. You can find archives and links for Cincinnati Edition stories at wvxu.org. I'm Mark Purcell. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned. Science Friday next on 91.7.